Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson. Episode 1, Le Monastier.
My dear Sidney Colvin, the journey which this little book is to describe was very agreeable and fortunate for me. After an uncouth beginning, I had the best of luck to the end. But we are all travellers in what John Bunyan calls the wilderness of this world, all too travellers with a donkey. And the best that we find in our travels is an honest friend. He is a fortunate voyager who finds many. We travel indeed to find them. They are the aim and the reward of life. They keep us worthy of ourselves. And when we are alone, we are only nearer to the absent. Every book is, in an intimate sense, a circular letter to the friends of him who writes it. They alone take his meaning. They find private messages, assurances of love, and expressions of gratitude dropped for them in every corner. The public is but a generous patron who defrays the postage. Yet though the letter is directed to all, we have an old and kindly custom of addressing it on the outside to one. Of what shall a man be proud if he is not proud of his friends? And so, my dear Sidney Colvin, it is with pride that I sign myself affectionately yours, R.L.S. In a little place called Le Monastier, in a pleasant highland valley in Haute-Loire, I spend about a month of fine days. As the name betokens, the town is of monastic origin, and it still contains a towered bulk of monastery and a church of some architectural pretensions, the seat of an archpriest, and several vicars. It stands on the side of a hill above the river Gazée, about 15 miles from Le Puy, up a steep road where the wolves sometimes pursue the diligence in winter. It is a town of lacemakers. The women sit in the streets by groups of 5 or 6, and the noise of the bobbins is audible from one group to another. There was one particular group who brought out a chair whenever I went by, and detained me from my walk to gossip. They were filled with curiosity about England, its language, its religion, the dress of the women, and were never weary of seeing the Queen's head on English postage stamps, or seeking for French words in English journals. The language, in particular, filled them with surprise. Bread, which sounds a commonplace, plain sailing monosyllable in England, was the word that most delighted these good ladies of Monastier. It seemed to them frolicsome and racy, like a page of Pickwick, and they all got it carefully by heart, as a standby, I presume, for winter evenings. I have tried it since then with every sort of accent and inflection, but I seem to lack the sense of humour. The town is notable also for drunkenness, for freedom of language, and for unparalleled political dissension. There are adherents of the 4 French parties, Legitimists, Orleanists, Imperialists, and Republicans, in this little mountain town, and they all hate, loathe, decry, and calumniate each other. Except for business purposes, or to give each other the lie in a tavern brawl, they have laid aside even the civility of speech. In the midst of this Babylon, I found myself a rallying point. Everyone was anxious to be kind and helpful to the stranger. This was not merely from the natural hospitality of mountain people, nor even from the surprise with which I was regarded as a man living of his own free will in Le Monastier. It arose a good deal from my projected excursion southwards through the Cévennes. A traveller of my sort was a thing unheard of in that district. I was looked upon with contempt, like a man who should project a journey to the moon, but yet with a respectful interest, like one setting forth for the inclement pole. All were ready to help in my preparations. A crowd of sympathisers supported me at the critical moment of a bargain. Not a step was taken, but was heralded by glasses round and celebrated by a dinner or breakfast. It was hard upon October before I was ready to set forth. And at the high altitudes over which my road lay, there was no Indian summer to be looked for. I was determined, if not to camp out, at least to have the means of camping out in my possession. For there is nothing more harassing to an easy mind than the necessity of reaching shelter by dusk, and the hospitality of a village inn is not always to be reckoned sure by those who trudge on foot. A tent, above all for the solitary traveller, is troublesome to pitch and troublesome to strike again, and even on the march it forms a conspicuous feature in your baggage. A sleeping sack, on the other hand, is always ready. You've only to get into it. It serves a double purpose, a bed by night, a portmanteau by day, and it does not advertise your intention of camping out to every curious passerby. This is a huge point. If the camp is not secret, it is but a troubled resting place. You become a public character. The convivial rustic visits your bedside after an early supper, and you must sleep with one eye open and be up before the day. I decided on a sleeping sack, and after repeated visits to Le Puy, and a deal of high living for myself and my advisers, a sleeping sack was designed, constructed, and triumphantly brought home. This child of my invention was nearly 6 feet square, exclusive of two triangular flaps to serve as a pillow by night and as the top and bottom of the sack by day. I call it the sack, but it was never a sack by more than courtesy, only a sort of long roll or sausage, green waterproof cart cloth without and blue sheep's fur within. It was commodious as a valise, warm and dry for a bed. There was luxurious turning room for one, and at a pinch the thing might serve for two. I could bury myself in it up to the neck, and for my head I trusted to a fur cap, with a hood to fold down over my ears and a band to pass under my nose like a respirator. And in case of heavy rain, I proposed to make myself a little tent, or tentlet, with my waterproof coat, 3 stones, and a bent branch. It will be readily conceived that I could not carry this huge package on my own merely human shoulders. It remained to choose a beast of burden. What I required was something cheap and small and hardy and of a stolid and peaceful temper, and all these requisites pointed to a donkey. There dwelt an old man in Monastier, of rather unsound intellect, according to some, much followed by street boys, and known to fame as Father Adam. He had a cart, and to draw the cart, a diminutive she-ass, not much bigger than a dog, the colour of a mouse, with a kindly eye and a determined underjaw. There was something neat and high-bred, a Quakerish elegance about the rogue that hit my fancy on the spot. Our first interview was in Monastier Marketplace. To prove her good temper, one child after another was set upon her back to ride, and one after another went head over heels into the air, until a want of confidence began to reign in youthful bosoms, and the experiment was discontinued from a dearth of subjects. I was already backed by a deputation of my friends, but as if this were not enough, all the buyers and sellers came round and helped me in the bargain, and the ass and I and Father Adam were the centre of a hubbub for nearly half an hour. At length, she passed into my service for the consideration of 65 francs and a glass of brandy. The sack had already cost 80 francs and 2 glasses of beer, so that Modestine, as I instantly baptised her, was upon all accounts the cheaper article. Indeed, that was as it should be, for she was only an appurtenance of my mattress, or self-acting bedstead on 4 castors. I had a last interview with Father Adam in a billiard room at the witching hour of dawn, when I administered the brandy. He professed himself greatly touched by the separation, and declared he had often bought white bread for the donkey when he had been content with black for himself. But this, according to the best authorities, must have been a flight of fancy. He had a name in the village for brutally misusing the ass. Yet it is certain that he shed a tear, and the tear made a clean mark down one cheek. By the advice of a fallacious local saddler, a leather pad was made for me with rings to fasten on my bundle, and I completed my kit and arranged my toilet. By way of armoury and utensils, I took a revolver, a little spirit lamp and pan, a lantern and some halfpenny candles, a jackknife and a large leather flask. The main cargo consisted of 2 entire changes of warm clothing, some books, and my railway rug, which, being also in the form of a bag, made me a double castle for cold nights. The permanent larder was represented by cakes of chocolate and tins of Bologna sausage. All this was easily stored in my knapsack. For more immediate needs, I took a leg of cold mutton, a bottle of Beaujolais, an empty bottle to carry milk, an egg beater, and a considerable quantity of black bread and white, like Father Adam, for myself and the donkey. Only in my scheme of things, the destinations were reversed. Monastrians of all shades of thought in politics had agreed in threatening me with many ludicrous misadventures and with sudden death in many surprising forms. Cold, wolves, robbers, above all the nocturnal practical joker, were daily and eloquently forced on my attentions. Yet in these, the true patent danger was left out. Like Christian, it was from my own pack I suffered, by the way. Before telling my own mishaps, let me relate the lesson of my experience. If the pack is well strapped at the ends and hung at full length, not doubled for your life, across the pack saddle, the traveller is safe. The saddle will certainly not fit, such is the imperfection of our transitory life. It will assuredly topple and tend to overset, but there are stones on every roadside, and a man soon learns the arts of correcting any tendency to overbalance with a well-adjusted stone. On the day of my departure, I was up a little after 5. By 6, we began to load the donkey, and 10 minutes after, my hopes were in the dust. The pad would not stay on Modestine's back for half a moment. I returned it to its maker, with whom I had so contumelious a passage that the street outside was crowded from wall to wall with gossips, looking on and listening. The pad changed hands with much vivacity. Perhaps it would be more descriptive to say that we threw it at each other's heads. And, at any rate, we were very warm and unfriendly and spoke with a deal of freedom. I had a common donkey pack saddle, a bard, as they call it, fitted upon Modestine, and once more loaded her with my effects. The doubled sack, my pilot coat, for it was warm and I was to walk in my waistcoat, a great bar of black bread, and an open basket containing the white bread, the mutton, and the bottles, were all corded together in a very elaborate system of knots, and I looked on the result with fatuous content. In such a monstrous deck cargo, all poised above the donkey's shoulders, with nothing below to balance, on a brand new pack saddle that had not yet been worn to fit the animal, and fastened with brand new girth, even a very careless traveller should have seen disaster brewing. That elaborate system of knots was the work of too many sympathisers to be very artfully designed. It is true they tightened the cords with a will. As many as 3 at a time would have a foot against Modestine's quarters and be hauling with clenched teeth. But I learned afterwards that one thoughtful person, without any exercise of force, can make a more solid job than half a dozen heated and enthusiastic grooms. I was then but a novice. Even after the misadventure of the pad, nothing could disturb my security, and I went forth from the stable door as an ox goeth to the slaughter.
Alan Cumming was reading the first episode of Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson, abridged in 8 parts by Stuart Conn. The producer was Tamsin Collison.